A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. Chapters 8 and 9. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapter 8. Morality Undermined by Sexual Notions of the Importance of a Good Reputation. I realized long ago that advice about behaviour and about all the various ways of preserving a good reputation, advice that has been so strenuously forced on the female world, is a glittering poison that forms a crust around morality and eats away its substance, and that this measuring of shadows produces a false calculation, because the length of a shadow depends so much on the height of the sun and other external circumstances. The easy false behaviour of a courtier, where does it come from? From the fact that the courtier needs dependence, so that he has to learn the art of denying without giving offence, and of evasively feeding hope with air. That is how politeness plays with truth, and, eating away the sincerity and humanity natural to man, produces the fine gentleman. Women, in the same way, acquire, from a supposed necessity, an equally artificial way of behaving. But you can't with impunity play with truth, because the experienced dissembler eventually becomes the dupe of his own arts, and can no longer quickly perceive common truths, which means that he loses his common sense. I mean truths that are constantly accepted as true by the unsophisticated mind, though it might not have had enough energy to discover them for itself. Most people take their opinions on trust, to avoid the trouble of using their own minds, and these lazy beings naturally adhere to the letter of the law, rather than its spirit, whether the law be divine or human. Some author, I forget who, wrote, "Women don't care about things that only heaven sees." Why indeed should they? It is the eye of man that they have been taught to dread, and if they can lull their watchful guardian to sleep, they seldom think of heaven or themselves, because their reputation is safe. And it is not chastity, but reputation, that they are working to keep unspotted, not as a virtue, but to preserve their status in the world. To prove the truth of this remark, I need only mention the intrigues of married women, particularly in the upper social ranks, and in countries where women are suitably married according to their respective ranks by their parents. If an innocent girl becomes a prey to love, and has a sexual affair before marriage, she is degraded forever, even if her mind wasn't polluted by the arts that married women practice under the convenient cloak of marriage, and she hasn't violated any duty except her duty to respect herself. In contrast, if a married woman is a false and faithless wife, she breaks a most sacred contract and becomes a cruel mother. If her husband still has an affection for her, the tricks she must use to deceive him will make her the most contemptible of human beings, and the contrivances necessary to preserve appearances will keep her mind in a childish or vicious tumult that destroys all its energy. I have known a number of women who, if they did not love their husbands, loved nobody else, devoting themselves entirely to vanity and dissipation, neglecting every domestic duty, even squandering the money that should have been saved for their helpless younger children, and priding themselves on their spotless reputation, as if the whole extent of their duty as wives and mothers was to preserve that. It would have been better if superficial moralists had said less about behaviour and outward observances, and more about the underlying frame of mind. For unless virtue of any kind is built on knowledge, it will produce only a kind of insipid decency. Yet respect for the opinion of the world has been explicitly claimed to be woman's principal duty. For Rousseau declares,
"Reputation is as indispensable as chastity. A man, secure in his own good conduct, depends only on himself, and can brave public opinion. But a woman, in behaving well, performs only half of her duty. The other half is to be well thought of, because what is thought of her is as important to her as what she really is. so the system of a woman's education should in this respect be directly contrary to that of men's education. Opinion is virtue's grave among the men, but its throne among women."
It is strictly logical to infer from this that the virtue that rests on opinion is merely worldly, and that it is the virtue of someone to whom reason has been denied. But even with respect to the opinion of the world, I am convinced that this class of reasoners, ones who think as Rousseau did about the matter, are mistaken. This regard for reputation, independent of its being one of the natural rewards of virtue, arose from a cause that I have already deplored as the grand source of female depravity, namely, the impossibility of regaining respectability by a return to virtue, although men preserve theirs during the indulgence of vice. This made it natural for women to try to preserve something that, when lost, can never be regained, namely, reputation for chastity. This became the one thing needed by the female sex, and the concern for it swallowed up every other concern. But neither religion nor virtue, when they reside in the heart, require such a childish attention to mere ceremonies, because when the motive is pure, the behaviour is certain to be mostly proper. To support my opinion, I can produce very respectable authority, and the authority of a cool reasoner ought to have weight, not to establish an opinion, but to make one take it into consideration. In his Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith observes,
"By some very extraordinary and unlucky circumstance, a good man may come to be suspected of a crime of which he was altogether incapable, and on that account be most unjustly exposed for the rest of his life to the horror and aversion of mankind. By an accident of this kind he may be said to lose his all, despite his integrity and justice, in the same way that a cautious man may be ruined by an earthquake or a flood, despite all the care he has taken. Accidents of the first kind are rarer than accidents of the second kind, and it still remains true that the practice of truth, justice, and humanity is a certain and almost infallible method of acquiring what those virtues chiefly aim at, namely, the confidence and love of those we live with. A person may be easily misrepresented with regard to a particular action, but it is hardly possible that he should be misrepresented with regard to the general tenor of his conduct. An innocent man may be believed to have done wrong, but this won't often happen. On the other hand, the established opinion that his behaviour is innocent will often lead us to absolve him in cases where he has really been at fault."
I entirely agree with this writer, for I believe that few people of either sex were ever despised for certain vices without deserving to be despised. I'm not talking about the short-term libel that hangs over someone's character, like a dense November morning fog over London, until it gradually subsides before the common light of day. My point is simply that the daily conduct of the majority of people stamps their character with the hallmark of truth. The clear light shining day after day quietly refutes the ignorant suspicion or malicious tale that has thrown dirt on a pure character. Many people obtain a better reputation than they deserve, strictly speaking. For if you work hard enough, you will reach your goal in almost any race. Those who strive only for this paltry prize, like the Pharisees who prayed at street corners so as to be seen by men, do indeed get the reward they seek, for the heart of man cannot be read by man. But the good reputation that is naturally reflected by good actions, when the man is trying only to do the right thing, regardless of the lookers-on, is in general not only more true, but more sure to be achieved. It's true that there are trials when the good man must appeal to God from the injustice of man, and, to the accompaniment of the hissing of envy, erect a shelter in his own mind to hide in until the noise has passed. And indeed it can happen that the darts of undeserved blame pierce an innocent, tender bosom with many sorrows. But these are all exceptions to general rules. So I venture to assert that after a man has reached maturity, the view that people in general have regarding his character is correct, allowing for the previously mentioned exceptions.
I don't deny that a prudent, worldly-wise man with only negative virtues and qualities may sometimes obtain a smoother reputation than a wiser or a better man. But the conspicuous ups and downs and the virtues of great men set each other in relief, and though they provide weak, envious people with a better target to shoot at, the real character will still work its way into the light, even if it is bespattered by the weak affection or ingenious malice of others. Morality is very insidiously undermined in the female world by the attention being given to the show instead of to the substance. This turns a simple thing into something strangely complicated. Indeed, sometimes virtue and its shadow are set at variance. We might never have heard of Lucretia if she had died to preserve her chastity instead of her reputation. If we really deserve to think well of ourselves, we shall commonly be respected in the world. But if we hunger for higher improvement and higher attainments, it is not sufficient to view ourselves as we suppose that others view us, though this has been ingeniously argued by Adam Smith, to be the foundation of our moral sentiments. Why not? Because each bystander may have his own prejudices in addition to those of his age or country. We should rather try to view ourselves as we suppose that God views us. The leading principles that run through all my discussions would make it unnecessary to go on about this subject, if it weren't for the fact that a constant attention to keep the varnish of the character fresh and in good condition is often taught as the sum total of female duty, with moral obligations often being pushed into second place by rules to regulate behaviour and preserve reputation. But with regard to reputation, the attention is confined to a single virtue, chastity. If a woman's honour, as it is absurdly called, is safe, she may neglect every social duty, even ruin her family by gambling and extravagance, yet still present a shame-free front, for truly she is an honourable woman. Mrs. Macaulay has rightly remarked that there is only one fault that a woman of honour can't commit without being punished. She then justly and humanely adds, this has given rise to the foolish observation that the first fault against chastity in woman has a radical power to deprave the character, but no such frail beings come out of the hands of nature. The human mind is built of nobler materials than to be so easily corrupted, and with all the disadvantages of situation and education, women seldom become entirely abandoned until they are thrown into a state of desperation by the venomous rancor of their own sex. But men despise this regard to the reputation of chastity, as much as women prize it, and the two extremes are equally destructive to morality. The depravity of the appetite that brings the sexes together has had a still more fatal effect. Nature must always be the standard of taste, the gauge of appetite, yet nature is grossly insulted by the voluptuary, the person who is dedicated to the pleasures of the senses. I'll discuss this, leaving the refinements of love out of the question. Nature makes the gratification of this appetite a natural and imperious law to preserve the species, and by so doing it exalts the appetite, bringing into the mix with the sensual appetite a little thoughtfulness and affection. The animal instinct gets a certain dignity from being mingled with the feelings of a parent. And because the man and the woman often interact on account of the child, a mutual interest and affection is aroused by the exercise of a shared sympathy. So mothers, having necessarily some duty to fulfil, more noble than to adorn their persons, would not contentedly be the slaves of men's casual appetite. Yet many women are just that. They are, literally speaking, standing dishes to which every glutton can have access. I may be told that bad as this sexual promiscuity is, it affects only one cursed part of the sex, cursed for the salvation of the rest. Well, it's easy to prove that it is never right to allow a small evil in order to produce a greater good. But that's not the end of the matter. The moral character and peace of mind of the more chaste part of the sex is undermined by the conduct of the very women who they insist are guilty.
These are women whom the chaste women inexorably consign to the practice of skills and tricks that lure their husbands from them, and debauch their sons. And they also force the modest women, who may be surprised to read this, to become to some extent like themselves. For I will venture to assert that all the causes of female weakness or depravity that I have already discussed branch out from one grand cause, the lack of chastity in men. This intemperance, so prevalent, depraves the appetite to such a degree that a wanton stimulus is necessary to rouse it. But nature's parental design is forgotten, and mere physical appearance alone engrosses the thoughts. Indeed, the lustful prowler often becomes so voluptuous that he outdoes women in female softness. To satisfy this type of man, women are made systematically voluptuous, and though they may not all take their libertinism as far as the man does, still this heartless interaction with males that they allow themselves depraves both sexes. The taste of men is vitiated, and women of all classes naturally adapt their behaviour to gratify the taste by which they obtain pleasure and power. In this way, women become weaker in mind and body than they ought to be, and don't have enough strength to discharge the first duty of a mother, for bearing and nursing children is one of the grand ends of women's existence. So they sacrifice to lasciviousness the parental affection that ennobles instinct, and either destroy the embryo in the womb, or throw it out when it has been born. Nature demands respect in everything, and those who violate its laws seldom do so with impunity. The weak, enervated women who particularly catch the attention of libertines are unfit to be mothers, though they may conceive, so that the rich male sensualist who has rioted among women, spreading depravity and misery, when he wants to perpetuate his name, receives from his wife only a half-formed being that inherits both its father's weakness and its mother's. I have already remarked that men ought to maintain the women whom they have seduced. This would be one means of reforming female manners, and, by giving disgraced women an alternative to prostitution, stopping an abuse that has an equally fatal effect on population and morals. Another equally obvious means of reforming female manners would be to turn the attention of woman to the real virtue of chastity. A woman's reputation may be white as the driven snow, but she is not entitled to much respect for her modesty if she smiles on the libertine, while spurning the victims of his lawless appetites and their own folly. Besides, she has a taint of the same folly when she studiously adorns her person only to be seen by men, to excite respectful sighs and all the idle homage of what is called innocent gallantry. Women who really respect virtue for its own sake won't look for compensation in the coin of vanity, for the self-denial they have to practice to preserve their reputation, nor will they associate with men who don't care in the least about anyone's reputation. The two sexes corrupt each other and improve each other. I believe this to be an indisputable truth, and I extend it to every virtue. Chastity, modesty, public spirit, and all the noble train of virtues on which social virtue and happiness are built, should be understood and cultivated by all mankind, otherwise they will be cultivated to little effect. And instead of providing vicious or idle people with a pretext for violating some sacred duty, by claiming that it is a duty for only one of the sexes, it would be wiser to show that nature has not drawn any line here, for the unchaste man doubly defeats the purpose of nature by rendering women barren and destroying his own constitution, though he avoids the shame that pursues the crime in the other sex. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9. The pernicious effects of the unnatural distinctions established in society. Most of the evils and vices that make this world such a dreary scene to the contemplative mind flow from the respect paid to property, as though flowing from a poisoned fountain. For it is in the most polished society that stinking reptiles and venomous serpents lurk under the nasty foliage, and there is voluptuousness pampered by the still sultry air, slackening every good disposition before it has time to ripen into virtue. One class presses on another, for they are all aiming to get respect on account of their property, and once they have that, it will bring them the respect that is really due only to talents and virtue. Men neglect their human duties, yet are treated like demigods.
Religion is also separated from morality by a ceremonial veil,
yet men are surprised that the world is, almost literally speaking, a den of cheats or oppressors. There's a shrewd truth in the homely proverb that whoever the devil finds idle, he will employ. And what can hereditary wealth and titles produce except habitual idleness? Man is so constituted that he can attain a proper use of his faculties only by using them, and he won't use them unless the wheels are first set in motion by some kind of necessity. Virtue, likewise, can be acquired only by the performance of one's duties to others, but the importance of these sacred duties will hardly be felt by someone who is cajoled out of his humanity by the flattery of sycophants. There must be more equality established in society, or morality will never gain ground, and this virtuous equality will not rest firmly, even when founded on a rock. If one half of mankind are chained to its bottom by fate, for they will be continually undermining it through ignorance or pride.
Until women are to some extent independent of men, one can't expect virtue from them. Indeed, one can't expect the strength of natural affection that would make them good wives and mothers. While absolutely dependent on their husbands, they will be cunning, mean, and selfish, and the men who can be gratified by the fawning fondness of spaniel-like affection don't have much delicacy, because love is not to be bought. Its silken wings are instantly shriveled up when anything is sought other than being loved in return. But while wealth enervates men, and women live, so to speak, by their personal charms, how can we expect them to perform the ennobling duties that equally require exertion and self-denial? Hereditary property perverts the mind, and the unfortunate victims of hereditary property, if I may use that word, swathed from their birth, seldom get either body or mind moving. And thus, viewing everything through one medium, and that a false one, they can't tell what true merit and happiness consists in. False, indeed, must be the light, when the drapery of situation hides the man, and makes him prowl about in masquerade, dragging from one scene of dissipation to another the nerveless limbs that hang with dull listlessness, and rolling round a vacant eye that plainly tells us that there is no mind at home. My point is that a society isn't properly organized if it doesn't compel men and women to perform their respective duties, by making that their only route to being viewed by their fellow creatures in the way that every human being wants to be viewed. So the respect that is paid to wealth and mere personal charms is a true northeasterly blast that blights the tender blossoms of affection and virtue. Nature has wisely attached affections to duties, to make the work sweeter, and to give to the activities of reason the vigour that only the heart can give. But when someone who doesn't perform the duties associated with a certain affection nevertheless puts on the affection, merely because it is the trademark of a certain kind of character, this is one of the empty compliments that vice and folly are obliged to pay to virtue and the real nature of things. For example, when a woman is admired for her beauty, and allows herself to be so intoxicated by the admiration she receives, that she neglects to perform the indispensable duty of a mother, she sins against herself by neglecting to develop an affection that would equally tend to make her useful and happy. True happiness, I mean all the contentment and virtuous satisfaction that can be snatched in this imperfect state, must arise from well-regulated affections, and an affection includes a duty. Men aren't aware of the misery they cause, and the vicious weakness they encourage, by only inciting women to make themselves pleasing. They don't consider that by sacrificing the comfort and respectability of a woman's life to voluptuous notions of beauty, they are making natural duties clash with artificial ones, when in nature they all harmonize. It would be a cold-hearted husband or one made unnatural by early debauchery, who didn't feel more delight at seeing his child breastfed by its mother than he could ever get from the most skilful tricks of seduction, yet wealth leads women to spurn this natural way of cementing the matrimonial tie and weaving esteem in with fonder recollections. The maternal care of a reasonable, affectionate woman puts us on her side, and the chastened dignity with which a mother returns the caresses that she and her child receive from a father who has been fulfilling the serious duties of his position is not only worthy of respect, but is a beautiful sight. I have viewed with pleasure a woman nursing her children, and performing the duties of her position with, perhaps, merely a servant-maid to manage the servile part of the household business. I have seen her prepare herself and her children, with only the luxury of cleanliness, to receive her husband, who returns home weary in the evening, to find smiling babes and a clean hearth. While my benevolence has been gratified by contemplating this artless picture, I have thought that a couple such as this possessed all that life could give. Raised above abject poverty, enough not to be obliged to think about every farthing they spend, and having enough to save them from needing to pursue a frigid system of economy that narrows both heart and mind. In my plain thoughts, I don't know what else is needed to make this the happiest as well as the most respect-worthy situation in the world, except for a taste for literature, to throw a little variety and interest into conversation, and some surplus money to give to the needy and to buy books. Riches and inherited honours are destructive to the human character, and are even worse for women than for men, because men can still, to some extent, develop their faculties by becoming soldiers and statesmen. The whole system of British politics, call it a system, is mere politeness, consists in multiplying dependents and contriving taxes that grind the poor to pamper the rich. Thus, a war, or any wild goose chase, is, in vulgar language, a bit of good luck for the minister, whose chief merit is his skill in keeping himself in place. But let me return to the more glittery slavery that chains the very soul of woman, keeping her for ever under the bondage of ignorance. The preposterous distinctions of rank that make civilization a curse, by dividing the world between voluptuous tyrants and cunning, envious dependents, corrupt every class of people almost equally, because the respect a person receives depends only on his rank, and not on his performance of his duties to others. And when the duties are neglected, the affections can't gain enough strength to fortify the virtue of which they are the natural reward. There are some loopholes out of which a man may creep, and dare to think and act for himself. But for a woman, escaping is a Herculean task, because the female sex faces difficulties of its own that require almost superhuman powers to overcome. A truly benevolent legislator always tries to make it in the interests of each individual to be virtuous. In this way, private virtue becomes the cement of public happiness, so that an orderly whole is consolidated by the tendency of all the parts towards a common centre. But the private or public virtue of women is very problematic, because many male writers, including Rousseau, insist that a woman should, throughout her life, be subjected to the severe restraint of propriety. Why subject her to propriety, blind propriety, if she is capable of acting from a nobler spring, i.e., if she has an immortal soul? What can be a more melancholy sight to a thinking mind than to look into the numerous carriages that drive helter-skelter about London in a morning, full of pale-faced creatures who are flying from themselves? I have often wished, with Dr. Johnson, to place some of them in a little shop, with half a dozen children looking up to their languid countenances for support. If that happened, I think that some latent vigour would soon give health and spirit to their eyes, and some wrinkles produced by the use of reason on the blank cheeks might restore lost dignity to the character, or rather, enable it to attain the true dignity of its nature. Besides, when poverty is even more disgraceful than vice, isn't morality cut to the quick? Still, though I consider that women in the common walks of life are called by religion and reason to fulfil the duties of wives and mothers, I can't help lamenting that women higher up the social scale don't have a road along which they can pursue more extensive plans of usefulness and independence. I really think, don't laugh, that women ought to have parliamentary representatives, instead of being arbitrarily governed without having any direct share in the deliberations of government allowed to them. This is just a hint. I mean to pursue it at some future time. But the whole system of representation in this country is at present only a convenient label for despotism, so women needn't complain, because they are as well represented as the many hard-working mechanics who pay for the support of royalty when they could scarcely feed their own children. Men whose very sweat supports the splendid horses of the heir apparent to the throne, or varnishes the chariot of some female favourite of the king's, how are they represented? Taxes, on the very necessities of life, enable an endless tribe of idle princes and princesses to pass with dull pomp before a gaping crowd, who almost worship the very parade that costs them so dear. This is mere barbarous grandeur, something like the useless parade of sentinels on horseback at Whitehall, which I could never see without a mixture of contempt and indignation. How strangely the mind must be damaged when this sort of state impresses it! But until these monuments of folly are levelled by virtue, similar follies will infect the whole mass. For the same character, in some degree, will prevail in the aggregate of society. And the refinements of luxury, or the vicious repinings of envious poverty, will prevent virtue from being the hallmark of that society, at most allowing it to appear as one of the stripes of the harlequin coat worn by the civilised man. In the upper ranks of society, every duty is performed by deputies, as though duties could be transferred, and the pointless pleasures that the consequently idle rich pursue appear so enticing to the next rank that the numerous scramblers for wealth sacrifice everything to tread on their heels. Women in particular all want to be ladies, which is simply to have nothing to do except listlessly to go. They hardly care where, for they cannot tell what. But what have women to do in society, I may be asked, but to loiter with easy grace? Surely you wouldn't condemn them all to breastfeed fools and keep household accounts. No. Women might certainly study the art of healing, and be well-paid physicians as well as very poorly paid nurses. And there is also midwifery, though men are now moving in on that. They might also study politics, and find the broadest basis for their benevolence, for the reading of history will hardly be more useful than the reading of romances, if it is read as mere biography, with no attention paid to the character of the times, the political improvements, arts, etc. The profitable approach to history regards it as the history of man, and not of particular men who fill a niche in the temple of fame and then dropped into the black rolling stream of time that silently sweeps all before it. Women might also pursue business of various kinds, if they were educated in a more orderly manner, and that might save many from prostitution and from marrying in order to have economic security. An unmarried woman may have had honourable reasons for choosing not to marry, and others may have been unable to marry. So it's a very defective government, one that entirely neglects the happiness of half its public, that doesn't provide for honest, independent women by encouraging them to occupy respectable positions in society. But to make their private virtue a public benefit, women must, whether married or single, have a civil existence in the state. The most respectworthy women are the most oppressed. This is a melancholy truth about the blessed effects of civilization. Treating them like contemptible beings will make them become contemptible, unless they have understandings much above the average for humanity, meaning both sexes. Many women waste life away, the prey of discontent, when they might have practised as physicians, run a farm, or managed a shop, and stood upright supported by their own industry, instead of hanging their heads. The woman who earns her own bread by fulfilling some duty deserves much more respect than the most accomplished beauty. I sigh to think how few women try to attain this respectworthiness by withdrawing from the giddy whirl of pleasure or the lazy calm that stupefies the good sort of women it sucks in. Proud of their weakness, however, these women must always be protected, they think, guarded from care and all the rough toils that dignify the mind. If this is what fate ordains, if they choose to make themselves insignificant and contemptible, sweetly wasting life away, let them not expect to be valued when their beauty fades, for the fairest flowers are pulled to pieces by the careless hand that plucked them. The most useful writers, in my opinion, are the ones who make man feel for man, independent of his social position and of the drapery of false sentiments. So I would like to convince reasonable men of the importance of some of my remarks, and prevail on them to weigh dispassionately the overall position that I have been defending. I appeal to their understandings, and as a fellow creature I claim, in the name of my sex, some interest in their hearts. I entreat them to help to emancipate their companion, to make her a helpmate for them. If only men would generously break our chains and be content with rational fellowship instead of slavish obedience, they would find us more observant daughters, more affectionate sisters, more faithful wives, more reasonable mothers, in a word, better citizens. We would then love them with true affection, because we would learn to respect ourselves, and a worthy man's peace of mind wouldn't be interrupted by the idle vanity of his wife, and his babes wouldn't be sent to nestle in a strange bosom because they never found a home in their mothers. End of chapter 9.